Good morning and welcome to this Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork. A warm welcome to each and every one of you. My name is Edna Trunzo and I am a member of this congregation. Ours is a shared ministry. Our minister, the Reverend Nancy Arnold, conducts services here 2 to 3 times each month. And on other Sundays, our service is led by guest speakers and worship associates. This morning, I would like to introduce and welcome our guest speaker, Michelle Dobbs.
Please do.
As many of you know, he practices Buddhism and has just recently moved from the Zendo in Sagaponack to our meeting house. He is the sensei of the Ocean Zendo Sangha. He is a husband, a father of three, how many? Two girls and a boy?
Two girls and a boy.
There. And he is a baker manager and a Zen practitioner for over 20 years, studying with, better known as Peter Matheson, and how would you pronounce that?
Muryo
Roshi. For 19 years, and he is becoming his first Dharma heir in 2005. I would also like to thank our musician, Nancy Remkes. She is recently retired from teaching 31 years at the Sag Harbor Elementary School, from which she is also well known for doing a wonderful job with the Morning Sing program. She is also an ordained interfaith minister, and she will be embarking on new territories with her ministry. She lives in Sag Harbor with her husband Tom and her beautiful daughter Sienna. Thanks again, Nancy, for being here with us today and helping make our service a very special and meaningful one. And we ask, of course, that you hold applause till the end of the service. We also extend a special welcome to those of you who may be new to our congregation or to Unitarian Universalism. We suggest that you attend at least 3 to 6 services to get a sense of the diversity of the worship experience here. Would you like to raise your hand or introduce yourself? No, everybody's okay? After the service, please join us for refreshments and conversation. Opening words this morning are, may we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and in miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. This is by Anonymous. Please join with me in reading the words found in your order of service for lighting our chalice, the symbol of our liberal religious tradition. This is the mission of our faith, to teach the fragile art of hospitality, to revere both the critical mind and the generous heart, to prove that adversity need not mean divisiveness, and to witness to all that we must hold the whole world in our hands. Our opening hymn this morning is hymn number 100. I've Got Peace Like a River, found in our gray hymnals. And we will sing the first 3 verses. Peace Like a River, in our gray hymnals. Number 100.
I've got joy like a fountain.
I call Michelle to the podium for our very first message this morning.
The first message is good morning. I want to tell a little story about keeping our vows and keeping our resolutions. And this is an old story about a Chinese Zen master who lived maybe 1,000 years ago. And his name was Bird's Nest Roshi. And they called him Bird's Nest Roshi because he liked to sit up in a tree. And one day, the governor of the province, who was also a poet, a well-known poet, came to see him. And he looked up at him, he found him up in the tree, and he said, "What a dangerous place you're sitting in, up in that tree." And Bird's Nest Roshi looked down and said, "Well, actually, your seat is much more dangerous than mine." And the governor, kind of nonplussed, looked at him and said, "Well, no, I'm the governor of this province. You know, my seat isn't dangerous at all." And the Roshi said, "Well, look in your heart and you'll see when you have power, you're in danger. And it's wise to steer clear of those kinds of things." And the governor was a little bit upset by this. He wasn't used to being spoken to that way. And he said, "What is the teaching of Buddhism?" And Bird's Nest Roshi quoted the Buddha himself, and he said, "Not to commit harmful actions, to do good actions, and to keep your heart pure. This is the teaching of all Buddhas." And the governor was very unimpressed by this, and he said to Bird's Nest Roshi, "A four-year-old knows that." And Bird's Nest Roshi said, "A four-year-old knows it, but an 80-year-old has a hard time doing it." So that's just something to think about in keeping, you know, how we stick to our resolutions and things. A lot of things are easy to know, and then finding our way to walk that way is sometimes work, our work. Yeah.
We are going to sing the children out with hymn number 413, Go Now in Peace. Light one more candle for all of the unspoken joys and concerns carried in our hearts. May the love and care of this congregation be with you in all the days to come. And please feel free to come up and light a candle during offertory. Now is our time for giving and receiving. There are two collections. The baskets are for the work of this congregation, and the glass bowl, which is the Helping Hand Fund, found in the back of the sanctuary, is for the work of the greater community. And the offering will now be given and received.
There is no love somewhere. There is no love somewhere.
Meditation, followed by a moment of silence and a musical response. I bring Michelle up for a few words of meditation.
So, I'd like to invite you to do any meditation you feel comfortable with, but if you'd like to try the basic meditations that we do in Zazen. The first thing is to not lean, to have your body upright in a relaxed way. And then to feel the breath coming into your body. And as it comes in, let your belly, your heart, your center, which is the center of your gravity right here below your belly button, let it expand as the air comes in, and then as you exhale, you push the air out, kind of like a billows, and just really bring your attention down to your belly.
I give you, Michelle, for our sermon.
So it was nice to sit like that. It's almost a shame to have to say anything other than that. My cousin once was driving with her teenage daughter at the time and her boyfriend on a long drive, and they were fighting, the boyfriend and the girlfriend, and so they were quiet the whole trip. And I said, "Wow, that must have been very uncomfortable." And she said, "I never interrupt silence." And so I think of that as a very high goal but one that I try to stick to if I can. That song that we just heard is called "The Gate of." It's called "The Gate of Sweet Nectar," and interestingly, it's an old. I believe it's a Hindu song, but it was adapted by my teacher's teacher, Bernie Glassman Roshi, into a service that is part of many of his the Zen Peacemaker Order, many communities in the Zen Peacemaker Order. He made a vow when he was in his 20s, I think, that he would end homelessness and hunger, and that he would feed the hungry spirits. And there's a Buddhist, an old Buddhist liturgy, which is called Feeding the Hungry Spirits. And we're actually going to start to work on adopting it and adapting it into our monthly services, because it's a really beautiful, wonderful. And what it does is invites us to, we invite all the hungry spirits, including those hungry spirits that are a part of us, the parts of us that are hurt and suffering, and we invite them into this beautiful meal, and we feed them. And he's made that a central part, as I said, of his Zen Peacemaker Order. And in that vow to end homelessness, he created something called Grayston in Yonkers, which was a community and still is a big bakery. And what it was created as was a bakery and a place that would offer jobs to people in Yonkers where there was high unemployment, because he felt that that was a critical way of getting people, you know, off the streets. And he said about his vow to end homelessness, it's a hopeless vow, you know. I can't end homelessness, but it's my vow nonetheless. And so that's kind of what I wanted to talk a little bit about. You know, after the joys and excesses of Christmas, we sit down and we start to look and gather up. And I think it's a natural thing at the end of the year to make resolutions. New Year's resolutions, when I read up on them, they date back to Babylonian history, you know. And actually, Romans would make promises to the god Janus, who is named for January is named after Janus. At the beginning of the year, they would make promises. I promise to exercise more, eat less, quit smoking, you know, all of the traditional promises, you know, take better care of myself and those around me. But it's funny because in spite of that impetus we make these resolutions, and I'm sure many of you have had a similar experience a week later, you know, after another night of gluttony or something, and we're like, oh, maybe next year, you know. So, and there was a scientific study that I read that showed that only 12% of resolutions are kept. So that's sort of disheartening, yeah. But so, you know, with that in mind, I'd like to look at the Bodhisattva vows. And there are four vows of the Bodhisattva, and they're chanted, we chant them. And they're chanted pretty regularly in services at the end of talks and things like that when we're together. On Monday nights, we chant them. And they go like this, and maybe I'll turn this off. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. or in Japanese, Shujo Muhen Segando, Bono Mujin Segandan, Homan Muryo Segangaku, Butsudo Mujo Seganjo. So, these vows, again, creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. So they're big vows, you know. If you think you have a hard time keeping your resolutions. But the other day I was listening to, I don't know if any of you know of Father Gregory Boyle. He's a Jesuit priest who started something on the West Coast called Homeboy Industries, which works with gang members. And an amazing, amazing, wonderful, wrote a book called Tattoos on the Heart, which I highly recommend. And he's been doing this work for a long time. And he said, if a thing is worth doing, it's worth failing at, you know? And it puts a whole different perspective on, you know, the things that we vow to do, you know, and maybe on these vows, you know. If it's worth doing, it's worth failing at, you know. When I first started practice, I remember maybe some of you know in France, or maybe in other countries, but my experience of it is in France, there are these old roads, and they're tree-lined, you know. And I guess to provide shade when people were kicking around in de chevaux or actual horses, you know, so they're really old roads and they're tree lined and they just go straight for on and on and on. They just go straight. And I remember when I first started practicing, the image came really vividly to me of being walking on one of those roads, you know. There's no end to it, you know. You just keep walking. But I felt really comforted that I was on the right road, you know. I thought. Then I found out I was in Italy, but no, but it's a long, long road, but we're at home on it, so that's a comforting thing. So these vows are thought of as the fundamental vows of the Zen Buddhist path, of the Mahayana. So Mahayana is an expression that's used only by people in the Mahayana. It means the greater vehicle, and it's a division which is really a sort of false division. But in Buddhist schools, there's the Hinayana, but more respectfully called the Theravadan tradition, the way of the elders. Hinayana means lesser vehicle. So you can see that that's a derogatory expression used by Mahayanas. but in the Theravadan sort of ideal for practice was the arhat, the one who was liberated. And in Mahayana, it developed a kind of a bigger perspective, which was, I can't be liberated unless everything is liberated. And so therefore, my practice is to save everybody, and I'm the last one out of the room, you know. I remember speaking to a woman at work one time, a devout Catholic woman who was worried about me because she heard that I didn't believe in heaven and hell. And she said, well, aren't you worried about going to hell? And I said, well, no. Actually, my vow is I'm the last one out of hell. And I'll close the door behind me. You know, that's the vow of the Bodhisattva, is to save all beings, you know. And a Bodhisattva is literally like an enlightenment being, a being of enlightenment. Even making these vows, we open that part of us, all of us, which is compassionate, which is enlightened. which sees beyond its own desires and anxieties. And so these vows are really closely related to the Four Noble Truths. I'll just point that out briefly. So the Four Noble Truths are the first teaching of the Buddha, supposedly, were the Four Noble Truths. And what they were was that life is characterized by suffering or anxiety. And often it's thought that Buddhism is therefore a very negative religion because life is suffering. But it's not that life is suffering, it's that there's a tendency in life, there's a characterization, there's a flavor in life where we think something is missing, and so we're not comfortable, you know, and we suffer. And so how that's related, right, that first vow is, creations are numberless, I vow to free them from their suffering. And then the second noble truth is that there's a cause to suffering, and that cause to suffering is our delusions and we're looking through the wrong lens, you know. We perceive everything to be about me going out, and actually I don't exist. I think that it was Einstein who said, I'm an optical delusion. You know, because I exist now in this body form, I think that I identify strongly with this body form, and I think this body form is real and separate from all other body forms. You know, Peter Murillo Roshi used to say, it's like a bottle filled with seawater on the bottom of the ocean, thinking that it's separate from the ocean. That's how we live, you know. And I always loved that, you know. And one day the bottle breaks and the ocean becomes the ocean, you know. So, or another metaphor that's often used is it's like a wave, thinking that it's separate from the ocean. I'm a great wave, look at me, you know. Splash. So the third one, right, is related to the end of suffering, which is nirvana, yeah, which is enlightenment. And so this end to suffering is what we say when we say, you know, the Buddha way. It's actually the fourth. They kind of get flip-flopped here in terms of the noble truths matching up with the four great vows, but it's the Buddha way is unsurpassable, or the enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. I vow to become it. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, the Buddha way. The Eightfold Path, which is third vow, which is the dharmas are or we say reality is boundless. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to perceive it. Boundless, by the way, it's funny because Bernie named many of his teachers after names that are in these four verses. So Murillo, Peter Mathiesen's Dharma name, comes from the third one. Boundless, it means boundless, which he now is completely, we hope. So typically we live in this kind of habitual way, you know, of being, we live in this body and we want to take care of it. And it's a natural thing, you know, but we become really pulled by it to almost a desperate level where my needs come above everybody else's needs. And in fact, it's not even my needs anymore, but it's my anticipated needs. And, you know, maybe I didn't get enough stuff at Christmas, so I think I'll go shopping today. Or whatever, you know. And meanwhile, we miss, like, there's a lot of hurt going on in this world. So that's, habitual actions are karma, That's what's called karma. You know, typically we think of karma as cause and effect, and cause and effect is part of karma, but karma is actually the actions. It's what we do. And those things are caused by whatever has happened to us in the past. But we typically kind of get neurotic about our needs. I don't know if any of you do, but I promise you that I do. So taking these vows is a step away from this and opening into a bigger life, noticing that our life and the life of the birds and the trees and each other and, you know, of the people who are hurt and suffering, that those lives are not separate, you know. And much of traditional Zen training moves us into this path. Just sitting, I don't know if anyone noticed, but just sitting, you know, there's an impulse to get up and do something, or to get on with it. Like, okay, are we done now? Are the 10 minutes up here? You know? And so when you sit Zazen for long, long periods of time, you start to notice and recognize how those impulses are just constantly pulling you around through the day. And you learn to just settle, maybe, and sometimes live life on life's terms instead of on yours. So, and if you go further in the training, a lot of the relationship that one has with the teacher is all about this. You know, I remember one time Peter asking me at a very difficult time in my life to do something which was difficult for me to do. He wanted me to go with him to Auschwitz. And my father had just been diagnosed with lung cancer, and it was kind of a difficult time for me. And I didn't really want to go, you know. But he didn't often ask me to do things so directly. And so I went, you know. And I don't know that it was the right thing or not to go. It was certainly a moving experience to be there with him. But, you know, I came back. Things were still difficult. But, you know, a lot of the teacher-student relationship, I don't know if you know the Tibetan teacher Milarepa. There's a book about Milarepa, and his teacher asks him to build a temple, and he builds the temple out of stone. It takes him 7 months or something. And he goes, you know, it's blocking the sunrise. You know, if you could move it over 15 feet, I think it'd be perfect. And he does this for 20 years. He rebuilt the temple like so many times, you know. And that story is about that, about just doing the act. It's like being Sisyphus, you know, and finding joy rolling the boulder up the hill. Because it's going to roll down again, you know. So they're a reminder to those of us who practice these vows that the root of our suffering is our self-centered perspective and our actions, and that to move away from that, you know, we need to be concerned with the well-being of all beings. And when I first heard them, I thought they were ridiculous. The emphasis of my practice was about awakening, waking up myself, me waking up. And I heard them and I was like, yeah, sure, that's great, you know. And then slowly they, you know, singing them over and over and over, it started to kind of sink in. And there's this poem by Ryokan that's at the beginning of the Order of Service, which is a really lovely poem, Happiness of the Bodhisattva Vow. When I see the misery of so many in this world, their sorrow becomes mine. Oh, I wish that my monk's robes were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world. Nothing makes me happier than the vow to save us all. And I remember, I never have understood these vows, though I continue to make them, but I remember feeling that joy of when suddenly I realized that this, you know, practicing wasn't about me, and my life really wasn't about me. So, that's a wonderful thing. And I was listening the other day to another Jesuit priest. Maybe I'm becoming a Jesuit, but I'm a closet Jesuit. But Father James Martin, and it was funny because he was speaking about something called agere contra, which is to act against your habits and instincts. And it's a critical part of Jesuit training, of Ignatian spirituality. And so I was struck, wow, that's exactly what I was, you know, I've been talking about here, you know. I find that language of acting counter to, in a way, I think that it's really acting more in harmony with our real natural heart. At least it has been to me, because I've felt that when I do it, my heart opens up and I feel much more joyful. So I share that with you. Make impossible vows, you know, make some really tough resolutions, along with the little resolutions. And resolutions are great, you know, they're fine. But make some big ones this year, you know. Feel free to fail at them, you know, because they give you a direction, they give you a compass, you know, and that, I think, for me at least, has proven to be a very important thing. So, good luck.
Our closing song this morning is "Auld Lang Syne," the traditional, and the yellow papers that were handed out in your class order of service. On the flip side of that is the words to "Auld Lang Syne." And Nancy will play it as we sing along. You may stand if you like. We'll sing. Closing words this morning are, the peace which passeth all understanding, the peace of God, which the world can neither give nor take away, be among us and abide in our hearts.